stuff.
Either way.
You do the stuff.
Either way.
If you want to.
All right. Now, your full name.
And I don't talk into anything, just talk.
Just talk right there. We got it.
My full name is Donald T. Warner.
The T stands for?
And T stands for Ticknor.
So would you spell that for me, please?
T-I-C-K-N-O-R.
And when and where were you born, Mr. Warner?
I was born on May 13th, 1921, in New York City. And but I subsequently, as a small baby, I grew up in Salisbury, Connecticut.
Let's hold it there just for a second. Do you remember the how many months or years you were when you came here with your folks?
I don't remember. I was just a few months old, yeah. I'm sure.
Oh, good. Now, how far back does your family go in Salisbury?
Both sides of my family, my father's family and my mother's family, which was the Scoville family, go back a long ways in Salisbury. Perhaps I ought to take my father's family first. My great-great-grandfather was the first person from whom I'm lineally descended who lived in this area. And he was a farmer who had a large farm, probably, you would say, in the southwest corner of Lakeville Lake, near the Indian Mountain School Road and the Interlochen Road. And his name was Harvey DeForest Warner. And he was not born here. I think he was born in Danbury. He was born in 1769 and died here in 1859. One of his children was Donald Judson Warner, my great-grandfather, who was born in 1819 and died in 1904. He was a lawyer, and he was also into politics. Modest degree, was a judge of the Court of Common Pleas, I think. And he had, his office was in the little red office building, which is next to the Congregational Church in Salisbury. And he lived in Salisbury in a house which is has been completely rebuilt, but is next to Dr. and Mrs. Effie Smith's house on Main Street in Salisbury. My grandfather, who was born in Salisbury in 1850, lived until 1929, and he was a lawyer also, and much more prominently involved in Connecticut politics. He was state's attorney for a longer period, I think, than anyone else, from around the turn of the century until 1917. He was at one time a close race to be nominated for governor of Connecticut. After being state's attorney, he was appointed a judge in the Superior Court. He served there until retirement age and then was a referee in the Superior Court, dying in 1929. My father was born in Salisbury in 1885, and he died in 1956. He also was a lawyer. Both he and my grandfather used that same office building, and my grandfather's partner, and subsequently my father's partner, was a man named Howard F. Landon. My father was Secretary of State of the State of Connecticut, 1921 to 23. I was born in New York and then came to Salisbury as a small baby. Now, to go to my mother's side quickly, they too were longtime residents, and the Scoville family owned a lot of land in the Taconic Chapinville area of Salisbury. The Undermountain Inn was the Scoville homestead where Jonathan Scoville lived, and where I believe my Jonathan Scoville being my great-great-grandfather, and my great-grandfather Samuel Church Scoville also lived there, and descendants of the Scoville family have lived there until about 1950. My grandfather and great-uncle were Nathaniel C. Scoville and Jonathan Scoville. I think they were brought up as very young boys and young men in this area, but they moved to Buffalo and they got in the forging business, and J. and N. C. Scoville made most of the railroad wheels for the country in the 1860s and 70s. My great uncle Jonathan Scoville, who never married, was a good friend of Grover Cleveland's, succeeded him as mayor of Buffalo. He was a Democrat, and later was a congressman from Buffalo. But the Scovilles had built, I'm not sure whether it was before these two gentlemen died, the Scoville house up in Taconic. They died in the around 1895, within a couple of years of each other, and Jonathan Scoville's will was the one that provided most of the money for the Scoville Memorial Library. One of their sons, Robert Scoville, was instrumental in rebuilding the town hall, as it was until last summer, around 1914, and they also ran a very large farm operation up in the Taconic called Grassland Farms, and did own a lot of land. My great-great uncle was Samuel Church, and the Church homestead is down on the Housatonic River, is now owned by somebody named Herndon, I believe. It was the, it's the big farm and large place on the Housatonic River at the foot of Smith Hill. And Samuel Church was one of the early graduates of Tapping Reeve Law School in Litchfield, and he delivered the centennial address in 1841, I guess, when Salisbury was 100 years old, and was a lawyer and was Chief Justice of the State of Connecticut. I think that more or less covers the family background, but really, I am really a native. When I hear about other natives, I don't know about, I don't know whether I like being a native that much, but I am.
You mentioned that there was a Harvey Warner, I believe, who
Harvey DeForest,
who came from Danbury.
Right.
To, was he the first of the Warners to be in Salisbury? Or
yes, as far as I know.
And in terms of the Scovilles, were they here before 1769?
I think that the Jonathan Scoville, the father of Samuel Church Scoville, who was my great-grandfather, they were Scovilles living in that place where the Under Mountain Inn is. That was the homestead there on the Under Mountain Road. Certainly they were there around 1800 at any rate.
I see. Do you happen to know where the Scovilles and Warners came from? I presume Europe, but just from...
I am a direct descendant of Andrew Warner, who came from England. And that branch of the family settled in the Connecticut River Valley, I think near Haddam, Massachusetts, so in the Connecticut River Valley area. And then I'm a direct descendant from that. The Scovilles are a very prolific family in this part of the world, and also in Ohio, when people moved from Connecticut to Ohio. And the name is spelled differently, sometimes without a double L-E, like Scoville Manufacturing in Waterbury.
Just a single L?
Yes. And that's,
in other words, S-C-O-V-I-L?
Yes, the manufacturing company that Secretary of Commerce Baldwin was head of. That's the same family, very distant relations to me, I suppose. And also there's some in Cornwall around Hartford. And they originally were French, I think. Maybe there was a little stopover in England, but I think that's French. Mm-hmm. Someplace in Normandy or something, I believe, is where they...
Do you know the reasons they came to this country?
Idea. Right. They didn't come first class, I'm sure. I don't know.
Were they Mayflower people or subsequent to that?
Subsequent to that.
Uh-huh, right.
Although not too much.
Were there any participants in the Revolutionary War?
Oh, yes, I believe so. But I, going back behind Harvey DeForest, there was, I think, Noah Dyer. I don't have the direct descendant list, starting with Andrew Warner. There was a John Warner and Noah Dyer, and then I think another John. There were some that fought in the
With the American side.
Yes. They weren't rich enough to be in the Tory side.
Okay. One of the areas that I recently have been exploring is the Shays Rebellion, which was in this area. Mm-hmm. Any of your family on either side of that issue?
I don't know. That was around 1794.
It ended about 1794.
And that was around Great Barrington?
It was strong in Great Barrington, but there some of it did take place in Salisbury, more in Sharon.
I don't know.
Right.
I knew it was around here, but I don't know about that.
Right.
Maybe they kept it very quiet if they were.
Well, I must say I'm impressed with what the courage of what those people did. You mentioned that there was a genealogical book on your family.
Oh, yes. And I'm sure that, I don't know whether the library has it, but I have a copy, and probably the library has it.
Do you know the name?
Descendants of Andrew Warner.
Descendants of Andrew Warner.
Yeah.
Published when and by
around 1915, I think. I have a copy of it.
Do you know offhand who published it?
No.
No. Okay. All right.
And there is a Scoville genealogy too, the Scoville family, I think, but it's not as easy to follow in that one as it is in the Warner one, at least for our branch.
Now, your family then was in the area here during such times as, let's say, the Civil War.
Yeah.
Was, to your knowledge, any participation in that issue or in the abolitionist issue?
Well, my grandfather would have been too young. I guess by the time my great-grandfather, when the Civil War came along, was already in his 40s. They were not. I had other relatives on my father's side who were, but not that I know of. No.
Okay. another big area in our history was the Spanish-American War, through which your family was in this area. Was there any?
No, I don't think any. There again, I had cousins on my father's side, or one in particular fought in the Spanish-American War, but I don't know. As far as I know, none.
Did you know your great-great-grandfather? Was he still living when you...
The only one I knew, they all had quite a bit of longevity. The only grandfather I knew of the two was Judge Warner, and he died when I was about 8 years old, and I remember him, but I...
Remember any stories about him or anything?
Well, I remember he used to walk from his office to his house, which is where Buckley and Buckley have their antiques in Salisbury, and that was his home, and it had been his my great-grandfather's home, I think, too, but mainly my grandfather's, and he always had peppermint candies in his pocket, and if we were could waylay him on the footpath, it was just a little footpath going down, he would hand out peppermints. I remember him up on Mount Riga. He had a lot to do with the putting together the Mount Riga Corporation, and I remember my grandmother. They always used to, if we went there as little children on Friday, they always had fish on Friday, and she made very good fish cakes, which nobody eats nowadays unless they get them out of a can, but these were good.
Homemade, yeah.
Yeah, homemade ones were sure. Out of sight.
Sure.
On my other grandfather died in the 1890s. He was born, I think, in 1831, and my grandmother was much, much younger, and he died in around 1890 or so, and she didn't die until 1944, so she was a young widow.
So you knew her then?
Oh, yes, I knew her.
What was she like?
Well, she was the, even though it was 1944, she was more or less the typical Victorian widow. She only wore black, mauve, lavender, or white, and was that was it. I guess she was sort of in mourning all the time, although I never remember her talking about her husband.
How big a family were you part of, your immediate family?
My own?
Yeah.
I have two sisters and a brother, mm-hmm. all of whom are living.
Oh, in the area here?
No.
No. What did your father do? I think you did.
He was a lawyer.
He was a lawyer.
Right.
Uh-huh. And what was he like?
Well, he was here in Salisbury all his life. He was a graduate of Yale Law School. He really never left the area except to be Secretary of State. Sort of a curious story. Somebody told me, he was a lawyer, has long since been dead. Shouldn't be telling us about my father. There was a mistake. They put him on the ballot to be Secretary of State, and they really meant to put my grandfather. I don't know if it's
did
true.
Did he win?
Yes, he won. That's what I heard, but I don't swear to that.
Your mother was of the Scoville family?
She was a Scoville. She was the youngest child of Francis Scoville and Nathaniel Church Scoville.
Right. Uh-huh. Very good. Found it so very interesting.
I do know.
Oh, you certainly, that's marvelous. That's really good. You mentioned one of the schools that you attended. Could you give me an idea of your own?
Well, I when I was very small, I went to the Salisbury grade school, which was a very minor type school near the White Hart Inn, and then...
Was that a one-room school?
No,
house?
Not
no,
really,
it was beyond that
really,
already.
Beyond
yeah.
That. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not that old.
Right.
Then, let's see. I went as a day student, I think, maybe boarding part-time to Indian Mountain School was then in existence.
Oh.
from then I went away to school, then I went away to college, then I was in the service. And
what college did you...
I went to Yale.
Oh, yeah, you were in Yale. And you were in the service in the Second World War?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What service, what part of service?
I was in the Army, and I was in the combat amphibious engineers.
Mm-hmm.
Then, after the war, I went to University of Virginia, Charlottesville Law School.
Oh, you graduated law school there.
Yeah. Excellent law school.
Mm-hmm. That's the Thomas Jefferson School.
That's right.
Yeah. Great. what was it like growing up here?
Well,
sounds very...
There are very few people that are around here now that I knew and ran around with and fought with and played with that still live in the area. But in the... I suppose my real recollection goes back to the late 20s and then the 30s, and then some of that time I was away at school. But for one thing, there was very little traffic on the road, not many big trucks. The road wasn't as wide. The bridge outside of my family's house, which is the one on the corner right opposite the library with a fence around it, was quite small. And there wasn't any shag roy. There was a Kimmerly's Market, which is where the sporting goods store is, and that's all been rebuilt. And there was a post office. The postmaster was Mr. Stone and Mrs. Stone, and drugstore, a couple of other little stores, but it was a very quiet village.
Were the Whitbecks in the Hutch Guard that time?
Yes, Sam Whitbeck was here then. And that you just didn't see a lot of traffic. Another thing was that, at least when you were a little boy, it was rather spooky if you were out in the village. There were no street lights. I don't think they were put in until the 40s, after the war. In other words, there weren't street lights going down the street. A sidewalk. There was a station behind the library, and the trains came. They were coming more and more infrequently, and there was a train master named Ashman. I can remember very well going on a train to Canaan, and even hopping on unnoticed going to Lakeville or Millerton. But unlike when my father was alive, when there were really a lot of trains and a lot of train service, that was beginning to die out as soon as World War II was over, really.
After World War II.
Yes, but even in the 30s and all, it was not as much as it used to be. Because there was no place. I mean, where were they going, trains particularly? There was a movie theater. And
In Salisbury?
No, Lakeville.
Where was it located?
Well, you must have been told this, but it was located near near where the public health nursing is, and
oh yes,
where there's a little on the run
pizza coffee
place, hurry up, get it. That burned down. That was still here when we were first married, though, I think, and it burned down, never was rebuilt. Going to movies was a big deal. Used to walk down the railroad track and go to the movies sometimes on Saturday afternoons when we were very little. It was a very simple existence. There was none of this. Very few people had started buying properties and coming here from elsewhere.
Well, when did that start? When did
the Well, I think it started to a certain extent, and some people who were friends of my parents did come from away and bought places. But I don't, in the 30s, late 20s or 30s, but it was on a very small scale compared to now. And I don't really think it started much until about 1950. It began to get going, and of course, picked up some momentum now. But it was very, very stagnant and very level for a long period of time.
Were there many after-school activities for children, or were you pretty isolated?
No, you entertain yourself.
Doing what?
Well, I don't know. Fish in the brook, or
things like
you
that.
Know. Yeah, there was there wasn't that uh-huh. sort of thing at all. Uh-huh. And even when I went away to school, I mean, you know, there was very little of that.
Let's say in your teens, when you were growing up, now today in the teens, teenagers seem to be lost pretty much in the community, it seems to me.
Well, I don't think we even thought about that particularly. Uh-huh. Nobody was worrying about it. We didn't think about it. We may have been lost in the community, but we didn't know it. So uh-huh. it didn't make much difference. Uh-huh. Right. People weren't concerned with that particularly.
Yeah.
It was a, well, Millerton, for example, even up to 1950 or so, there were 5 trains a day to New York City. And back in the 30s, there were probably more. And you'd go over to Millerton and get on a parlor car, probably to New York for $2 or $1.50 or something like that.
Not today.
And it was, people went, that's how they went to New York. You didn't drive.
Right.
I really don't remember much more than the word driving. I guess I did.
The 1930s was a big depression. Was that evident in any way in the year?
I would say, compared with other parts of the country, relatively less. Because, in the first place, there weren't any big industries around. And in the second place, if people did work in a place like Tarrington, brass companies were still zooming along in the Depression, pretty much. So I don't think it was so noticeable here, although I can remember friends of my family hearing about them losing their jobs and all that, but I don't remember seeing anything like bread lines or such things in this area. They never had it that all good, so it wasn't that all bad, I think.
What about the events that began to take place, let's say, in the middle 30s, like Ethiopia, Spain, Hitler, Mussolini?
This area was quite, even though we were in the sticks, it's my feeling that probably because of the schools, Hotchkiss, Salisbury School, quite a few people who were college graduates and all. I think there was quite a bit of awareness of the Spanish Civil War, which you, I know a lot about, having been connected with. I don't really remember too much about Ethiopia. Mussolini was a bad guy, but when the war actually broke out, the real World War, in September of 1939,
right.
There was a big pro-Britain thing and bundles for Britain and canning tomatoes for Britain and children, when the bombing really started, although I wasn't here that much then, but children coming here from Britain, some I think, and in the area, yes, and there, this was not an isolationist community, I don't think, although I wasn't that, being young, I wasn't that much.
Would you say that people at the time you were growing up, I'm thinking, was there a relationship to the background out of which people had come, whose families, you know, had been part of the American Revolution, part of the abolitionist Civil War period? Some, was there much of a relationship to these ideas?
No, I don't think so. Much more in Hartford, where the famous preacher, Harry Beecher Stowe, Beecher preached. And I don't think around here there was much that I know of. I never heard it discussed.
Right. Did Mark Twain rub off?
Oh, well, everybody knew he came from Hartford and all that, and yeah.
Right.
It was a pretty simple life.
The ethnic composition when you were growing up in the area?
Well, there were almost no blacks at all. There was a family named Gordon that lived down the street from where we did. It was in a tiny little tenant house, a house that belonged to my uncle, I think, at that time. I think they were the only blacks that I remember, or there was somebody in Oar Hill named Caesar or something like that, but very few. Now, there were of course, there's some descendants of Dutch, but that goes back very far. There was not much. There weren't many, for example, there were not many Italians here, and yet there were lots.
How about Lime Rock?
In Canaan and Tarnet. Lime Rock. Well, Lime Rock was so dead and moribund by then. There wasn't anything already there. The whole thing, all the houses, when Barnum Richardson went out of business, they were just empty houses, and there wasn't anything in Lime Rock until a man named Alfred Stone came along as a real estate broker, and he gradually managed to sell that. But Lime Rock was
By the time you were around, the
Lime Rock was nothing.
Lime Rock had already passed.
Oh yeah, it was passed.
Because I had interviewed a couple of people there who had told me about the Italians and Poles that predominated
in Lime Rock.
In Lime Rock, but that was at the time of they worked in the mines. I guess.
Oh well, yes, no doubt that's true,
yeah,
but I didn't.
That
know
was
that.
So that at the time.
Well, like the charcoal burners around here, both in Sharon and a lot of them around Salisbury, they came from France, they burn charcoal in the Ardennes. But I don't. When I was, there weren't any then.
I had interviewed a Mrs. Folks who spoke with some affection and respect for a Warner family. That was not your family.
I don't know.
She lives in Lime Rock.
Bertha Folks.
I'm not sure of her first name. I'd have to look it up. But she had come back with a Warner family, one of the Warner families from Florida. Her mother. No, that must have been another.
Well, it could have been
another relative of the family.
Relative.
Yeah. Now, what kind of comparisons come to the top of your head in terms of today, as opposed?
Well, today everything is. Without naming names, one real estate office in particular, and maybe some other ones, not quite as much, have changed the face of the area pretty much, and developments and lots and second houses and young, rich yuppies buying houses at very high astronomical prices. It's changed a lot. I can remember when I was first practicing law, talking to another lawyer here, and he said, "My God, Donald, I've had two closings in the past week, and they were both over $100,000. And that was in the 50s, I guess, or late 50s, something like that. So the changes were quite slow, but then really started picking up about 10 years ago. And a lot of people think we're going to be Wilton Jr. or Weston Jr. or something.
Does look like that.
I guess so. I think that's the most obvious change. The other thing is getting to be very difficult to get people to serve on various things around here. For example, I've had a lot to do both as a trustee, officer, and lawyer for Sharon Hospital. It's very difficult to get many people who are interested to serve on things like this. I know in our little library here, the Hotchkiss Library in Sharon, it's hard to get people. It's hard to.
People are not as civic-minded as.
Well, they just don't have the time. The ones that come up for the weekends and all, they're not going to do it. They rush to their high temple at Shag Roy, pick up their their delicious groceries and delis, and then go home with their friends and spend the weekend, and then roar back to New York late Sunday night. And they're not going to do it.
Were the town hall meetings well attended when you were?
I didn't go to town hall meetings when I was a kid. They were.
I was thinking when you got back here.
Well, I really wasn't here that much. You see, I went to law school.
Right.
But when I came back, we first practiced in Litchfield before opening an office, branch office of the firm here in Sharon. But yes, town hall meetings were quite well attended, and a lot of people went to see the fight or the, get the entertainment. Who was going to say skewer whom or something? Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know about Salisbury. I haven't been in zoning meetings here, but I think they're pretty well attended.
Sometimes.
Well, the fire bit.
Oh, yes, that really brought
around. Sparked a lot of latent interest.
That's very, very true.
I imagine they were pretty hot and heavy when I was a kid, but I don't. I wouldn't know for sure.
Yeah. What's your estimation of what the future is going to be here?
I think it's going to be an adjunct of Fairfield County. I don't see how they can stop it.
It already has lost some of its...
Well, I think that there's so much less farmland, and you can't blame the farmers, and the state can't go around protecting every farm, and prices are just out of sight. Maybe there'll be a burst in the bubble, but I don't know.
I had a children's camp up near Ware, Massachusetts. And
on the Cape?
Right near Springfield.
Okay.
I banked in Palmer, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And it was a banker who I guess was a little older than I am now, and I was somewhat younger, so to me he was old. I wouldn't say that today. And he said, "Bob, I want you to remember one thing for the rest of your life. Whatever goes up has to come down."
Well, that may be true, but I also feel that when I said it's hard to get people to be on various boards, non-governmental, I think it's hard, at least I think it is not easy in Sharon, probably not too easy in Salisbury, surrounding towns, to get people willing to serve on zoning boards, serve on the school board, and all that. It's not as easy, and they don't want to do it. And I suppose the ultimate breaking down of what the olden days were like might be, there'll be, because of course it'd have to be some sort of a consolidation of the towns, at least insofar as sharing in road equipment, sharing in various things, because I don't think these small towns can maybe eventually continue to do it where they're entirely autonomous. There may have to be something along that line, and I don't know, but that would be forced by financial considerations or economic considerations, I think.
As a former educator, I would be very interested in your estimation of education in the area as compared to your own growing up.
Well, I don't know, except in Sharon. We had five children, and except for one, all of them went to the Sharon Center School through the sixth or seventh grade or something, and it had its ups and downs. I really don't know now. I think the high school education under the current principal is definitely on the upswing, and it's going to be better. And I think the area is definitely going to accept that, whether they like it or not, in the very beginning. But Jack Mahoney is
an
excellent man, and I think that is much better. The prep schools around here, I really don't know that much about, although I'm a trustee of Salisbury School. And we do have a lot of local people, and nearly all of them are on scholarship.
On scholarship?
Well, maybe not 100%, but they're all getting some sort of scholarship. And I think we have about 30 there out of a school population of 240 or 250. Hotchkiss does the same. I'm not, except for the Salisbury School, I'm really not that close to what's going on. I think the high school is better.
Oh, definitely. I agree with you about Jack Mahoney.
Oh, yeah.
Good man.
Yeah, we're lucky to have him.
I do think so. Now, is there anything you can think of at all that you would like to add? That was a very comprehensive picture.
Because I don't even live in Salisbury. I don't.
Well, you grew up there, and so yeah. I'm sure.
Well, that's right.
And your family background, that is that.
Yeah, you know, there aren't really many other families like that.
Yes, they're just extensive.
That's true. And then my uncle lived here for years, now dead, Philip Warner, and he had a factory, knife handle factory, and all that. So the family background is...
Oh, without question.
Although those of my generation, I have one first cousin who lives in Lakeville, and first cousin once removed and lives in Salisbury. Most of them don't live here.
Ginger Gilman.
She is my first cousin.
Yeah.
And I think the reason is that unless you were a doctor or a lawyer and you decided you wanted to, or a few other things, decided you really wanted to stay and do live this kind of life, there really isn't anything for them to do. That's why they all took off. Although I know some friends of mine who wish they could come back, but they say they can't afford to buy. My God, they say we can't afford to buy.
How about your children? Will they look forward to settling here? Or?
Oh, I don't think any of them will. None of them. There's one in Vermont, one in Boston, one in Montana, one in Washington, D.C.
Across the country,
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, that seems to be
It's too bad, but that's the way life has changed. That's
it really has. So is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have?
Let's see, whether I beat my wife.
I know you don't.
I don't think I do. No.
Of course not.
I can't think of anything, Bob, really.
Okay.
What do you do with this after it's all done?
Let's cover Mount Riga, yeah.
Well, just briefly, I should have said something about Mount Riga, which is a corporation which was incorporated in 1922. As a land-holding company, a profit land-holding company, not a non-profit, which is a very unusual vehicle in those days. And that was done in the main by my grandfather and father. But my grandfather and great-grandfather were instrumental with two other families in buying up tax liens, etc., all that land, which was around 5,000 acres. And if it has been preserved the way, pretty much the way it has been for...
A real primeval area.
Yeah,
I love it.
For more than 100 years. Currently we have about 130 stockholders. They're all over the place, and we intend to keep it the way it is, and there's no electricity, and we maintain a lot of the roads up there, and of course there are the beaches and campsites where people can go. The whole history of Mount Riga is very interesting,
yes,
though, because this was the best iron ore one of the best iron ore places in the world, others being in Sweden and out in the northern Michigan near Negaunee and Marquette and the Sabi Range out there. So it was a humming place in the late 18th century and early 19th century until about 1830 or so. There's a lot of history about this in the library, Scoville Library. The irony of it all was that a Lakeville individual, Alexander Holly, who went to Brown, was a metallurgical engineer, died around 1890. He brought back the Bessemer process from England and Germany, from England, I believe. And once the Bessemer process was used, he got the patent for it, you could make much better iron from much less pure sources. It has to do with the heat, and this killed the industry here. And he was Governor Holly's son, and grew up in Lakeville. Very distinguished man, and many books written about him. And that killed the industry, which had helped make his family so prominent, and they were in the iron ore industry. And of course, indirectly, the Stoll family was too. That's how they got into the railroad wheel deal. A lot of cannonballs were made for the revolution, and links in the chain that went across the Hudson to keep the British frigates out around Nyack, New York, anchor the Constitution, etc. Supposedly were all forged here. And then they had the furnace around here, and one of the big ones was on Mount Riga. There used to be this a haze of smog and smoke. They burned everything. And that's when there was a village up on Mount Riga, which was quite thriving, and as soon as that, around the Civil War time, that went out, everybody abandoned the property there, and that's how that property was bought up by my great-grandfather and his, a couple of his friends. And then there was a big open pit at Ore Hill, which was very big. I think that was, they tried to revive and open that a little bit in World War I, but it wasn't profitable. And so the whole industry collapsed in this northern part of, northwestern part of Connecticut. So Salisbury does have that.
Let me just check a couple of myths that, okay, that exist. One